The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, July 18th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, NYU professor, or I should say Florence Kelly professor of history, Linda Gordon, on the second coming of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s, and the American political tradition. Also on the program, turns out Trump misspoke, so it's all good. Treasury now no longer requiring IRS reporting for dark money. Gene Shaheen to Bob Corker, put your committee where your mouth is. Call a hearing with the Putin-Trump interpreter. Meanwhile, four states sue, claiming the new Republican tax law is unconstitutional. It's over that property tax deduction. Andrew Cuomo sets a record for the lamest and most desperate attempt at seeming to attract small donors ever. Meanwhile, Trump's so-called zero tolerance policy causing a funding crisis for health programs. And ISIS is making a comeback in Iraq. And Mueller queuing up the Manafort trial, all this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, it is Wednesday, and really stunning to watch how all it took from Donald Trump was to say, when I said white, I meant black. When I said up, I meant down. And a dozen Republican senators can't run to a microphone fast enough to say, I'm cool with that. Let's just go over that. I mean, I imagine you've seen it, but it's worth watching again. Here is Donald Trump explaining yesterday. Now, recall the day earlier, Donald Trump had been asked, hey, your head of defense national, your head of the National Defense Intelligence Agencies has said that Russia meddled with the election. And you've got these indictments of Russian intelligence agents who meddled with the election. Is that a problem? Well, you know, Dan Coats says this, but, you know, Putin says no. So, you know, why would they do this? But apparently Donald Trump has reviewed the transcript of what he said 24 hours later and has decided, well, I'll let him say.
I thought that I made myself very clear by having just reviewed the transcript.
Pause it for 1 second. Yeah. I want you to know, if you're not watching this, he's literally reading this. So it's not like, oh, I want everybody to know I misspoke. Like, let me see if I could do this. Hey, remember yesterday when I said when I was talking about the question of unemployment and minimum wage?
Yeah.
I forgot to cite a piece in The Guardian that was that came out a couple of days ago. Now, you see how I did that extemporaneously, right? I hadn't even planned to say that. But Donald Trump is reading the fact that he made this one tiny mistake off of a script for him.
There was a mention that I thought I had made, but the transcript says...
Well, let's just watch him do it.
I thought that I made myself very clear by having just reviewed the transcript. Now, I have to say, I came back and I said, what is going on? What's the big deal? So I got a transcript. I reviewed it.
First off, every single advisor he has was on that trip with him. You know, like I came back, like, and I walked into the house. I'm like, why is everybody looking so glum? What happened? Did the dog die? Like they weren't aware of what he said the moment he got off the stage.
I said, what is going on? What's the big deal? So I got a transcript. I reviewed it. I actually went out and reviewed a clip of an answer that I gave. And I realized that there is a need for some clarification. It should have been obvious. I thought it would be obvious, but I would like to clarify just in case it wasn't. In a key sentence in my I said the word would instead of wouldn't. The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why I wouldn't or why it wouldn't be Russia. So just to repeat it, I said the word would instead of wouldn't. And the sentence should have been, and I thought it would be maybe a little bit unclear on the transcript or unclear on the actual video. The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia. Sort of a double negative. So you can put that in, and I think that probably clarifies things pretty good by itself.
Oh, yeah. Now I get it. Now I get it. Okay. So
message received.
Okay. So now I've gotten more confused now from watching it. So let's go back and see it in context. I think this will make it much clearer for those of you who got confused because he didn't want to use a double negative and instead just used a positive, I guess.
The question. My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be, but I really do want to see the server.
Huh. So, I really don't see why it would be, but I really do. I want to see the server. Okay.
Easy mistake to make.
It's such an easy mistake to make. And it's not like this is one of those high stakes, high diplomatic moments. And what is this? This is the...
It's the image taken of the notes that he was reading from.
Should add in, there was no collusion. Yeah, there you go.
Good. He's really putting his own touch on it.
Wow, somebody got a good picture of that.
And a collusion with one L there. I mean, not I'm not a big grammar and spelling Nazi, but, you know, just a note.
There you go. So this is
a little echo of last night and over 2 years, and now almost 2 years ago. But a biki bar, no Trump collusion, sakar.
Now, was this his, this is the picture of his prepared remarks,
yeah, you
right?
Can, you can sort of read at the top. It says, as I've said before, that I accept our intelligence community's conclusions about Russia's meddling in the 2016 election. Right after that, it says, there is no collusion.
There is no collusion. I thought I made it clear yesterday. Okay, so this is, and wouldn't, oh my God. I mean, he has to write all this out.
What did he cross out down there?
Putin is my friend. I like him. He is the best.
Yeah, it's just hard enough to read.
If I was going to collude with anyone, I'd collude with him because he's so cool. But there wasn't any collusion, so it's a lie.
So this is where we are with this. Folks, I would recommend you read a piece in the New Yorker magazine, because I always do that. I usually am either reading one or interviewing someone from New Yorker. It is an iconic magazine, represents the truly best writing in America today. I don't know if you're reading sort of regularly Masha Gessen in the New Yorker, but this week, I guess yesterday, she wrote How Putin and Trump Each Lied in Helsinki. And fascinating piece. Look, the magazine, do I really even need to push the New Yorker? You know the high quality writing that's in there, and it's super important. David Remnick's writing about AOC and the future of the Democratic Party. Robin Wright writing about the appeasement summit with Putin. What happens when a bad-tempered, distractible doofus runs an empire? Look, you can inform yourself about the most current events, get insight from New Yorker's writers. You find stuff like Shouts and Murmurs, The Critics, review of books, arts, movies, TV, more, poetry, literature, 4 long-form feature stories, cartoon caption contest, and more. And this is one of the most amazing features of it. You can access the complete archive, digital replicas of every issue of the print magazine from 1925 with your subscription. Just scrolling through that with your kids is worth it. Don't wait. Go to www.newyorker.com/majority. Receive 12 issues for $12 plus a free tote bag. However, if you enter my code MAJORITY, you will unlock 50% off your subscription. So you get it delivered to your mailbox, inbox, both by choosing between print, digital combination. Subscribe to The New Yorker. Read something that means something. You will be getting 12 issues for $6. And a free tote bag when you go to newyorker.com/majority and enter my code MAJORITY at checkout. Got to do both those things. newyorker.com/majority. Enter my code MAJORITY at checkout. Have we left a New Yorker ad in for members yet? We should do that because it's a great deal. We do that sometimes. I mean, when you subscribe to the Majority Report, we take out ads, but we try and leave at least one, more often than not, we try and leave the first ad in that we do on a run for these things for our members so that they hear our deals too. But all the information is always in the podcast description, both on the page and on, you know, when you get it via iTunes or however you get your podcast. But don't forget, members don't hear ads and they get extra content, and you can be one of those people who doesn't hear ads and gets extra content and supports this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And as always, if you do not have the finances to swing it, send us an email and we will hook you up if you want that extra content. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Linda Gordon, NYU history professor, on the second coming of the KKK. Apparently, there's been more than one. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the Florence Kelly, a professor of history at NYU and author of The Second Coming of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s, and the American Political Tradition, Linda Gordon. Welcome to the program, Linda.
Thank you for having me.
So, all right, let's start. Well, I don't know that... I don't know. Most people perceive the KKK as having had basically three waves. I don't know that most people realize that. But will you first just tell us about the three different waves? Obviously, you focused on the second wave. But just tell us broadly about the three different waves, just so we have a context for where your work is done here.
Sure. I think that most people's association with the Klan has to do with the first wave, when the Klan was a secret and really literally a terrorist organization that developed immediately after the Civil War in the South. Its main tool was violence, sometimes nonviolent intimidation, but the threat of violence. And it had one purpose, and that was to make sure that white supremacy in the South was not challenged. And I call it terrorist in the literal sense of what terrorism means, and that is that when the Ku Klux Klan went to lynch some guy, the what they had against that particular person was only part of the purpose. The general purpose was to intimidate the whole African-American population in the South. The second Klan...
And we should just say,
about,
just so that, I mean, we can be
sure.
Specific, we're talking about more or less the period of Reconstruction. In the case of the Klan, late 1860s through essentially the 1870s.
No, actually, I'm talking about the whole of the period from Reconstruction all the way through into the early 20th century. In that period of time, more than 4,000 people were lynched. Now, they weren't all lynched only by Klan members, but the Klan was certainly the symbol and the organizing force behind that violence. The second Klan really did not consider itself separate from the first Klan, and that's why I call the book The Second Coming. But it had a very different strategy and a very different constituency. And probably the most important thing that I think most people don't understand about the Klan of the 1920s is that it was strongest in the northern states. And it had somewhere between 3 and 6 million members. We are talking about a really mass movement. And unlike the first Klan, it was not at all secret. People were proud of their membership. They advertised publicly in newspapers. They recruited publicly. They had traveling Klan speakers all over the country. So that was part of what was different. And the other part is that they, you might say, expanded their enemies list. I think understanding that in the 1920s, there was still only a fairly small population of African Americans in the North. And the second Klan focused its bigotry on Catholics and Jews and immigrants, but immigrants because the immigrants who had been coming into this country in the early 20th century were mostly Catholics or Jews. Then there was...
We'll circle back to those questions just so that we can get the sort of first the survey of the three different waves, as it were.
The third wave is a Klan that re-arose, you might say, in response to the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s. And that Klan still exists today. And you might even say that with this current spate of white nationalists, we're in a fourth revival of the Klan. But I think it's important to understand that today the Ku Klux Klan is only one small, relatively small fraction of these many white nationalist groups. But certainly there are many groups that are continuing the spirit of the Klan.
So, all right. So when we look at the second wave, let's start with that notion of the flexibility, their capacity to grow in the sense that they expanded the playing field for who they were going to, I guess, professionally hate. Why was the rise of the second wave of the Klan and their sort of, I guess, slightly changed focus, was that a function of immigration, or was it a function because Jim Crow era laws had been, you know, successful in sort of, as a blowback against emancipation? What gave rise to it?
The major force was immigration. Starting in the 1880s, there were really millions of people coming into this country from Europe, from the Middle East, from Eastern Europe. And what characterized this period of immigration is that most of these people were not Protestants. There were Jews from Eastern Europe, Catholics from Southern Europe, Orthodox from Eastern and Eastern Europe and the Middle East. Now, there had been an anti-immigration movement in the United States for a long time. It used to be referred to as nativism. But the Klan really built on this anti-immigration stuff by doing what I think all kinds of this kind of demagogic movements do, and that is that they built on fear. And they built that by making all sorts of somewhat bizarre allegations about how these immigrants were plotting to really overturn not only the government of the United States, but to take control of it by a foreign force. Let me point out that when I started to do this research, I was asking myself, how could people have believed these extremely bizarre allegations? And I could give you some examples. But I think as time went on, we are beginning to see today that you can somehow make people accept conspiracy theories for which there is no evidence.
Linda, literally as you were saying that, I was thinking of a clip that we played yesterday of the highest rated cable television program, news program in the country, or second highest, I think Tucker Carlson, saying that in terms of meddling with our elections, Mexico has done far more by packing our electorate, he said. I mean, and we heard, I mean, the president of the United States for a year contended that 4 million illegal immigrants made up the difference in the popular vote in this country. And we formed an entire commission on it. So it becomes far too easy, I guess, to contemplate what people would buy. And I would imagine, I don't know, maybe it's less or maybe it's easier or harder at that time to disseminate these things. They didn't have an internet, but at the same time, you didn't have an internet. So you could both, I think, you know, there was no Snopes, as it were, to debunk these things. Okay, so how much of it was a genuine fear and how much of it was because what you describe in the book is a broad-based, almost like social hierarchy. I mean, it's a combination of like almost like Groupon and you know the Kiwanis Club and it's a society within a society in many respects. How much was there a profit motive involved in this?
Oh, okay. Well, I have to take these things one at a time.
Please.
First of all, like many social movements, it gave rise to all kinds of activities. For example, the Klan had baseball teams. They had bands. They had youth clubs, they had sewing circles, they et cetera, et cetera. You could live your life within a Klan community. Well, you started by asking about fear, and let me just say, you asked, was it genuine? And I would just like to point out that you can genuinely be fearful, but in a situation in which these fears have been essentially constructed by this kind of demagogic rhetoric. One of the conclusions I've come to as to how you get people to believe bizarre allegations, let me give you one example of what I mean on a large scale. One of the allegations is that all these immigrants pouring into the United States were not coming because they were poor or because, in the case of the Jews, they were persecuted. They were coming because they had been ordered to do so. The Catholics had been ordered by the Pope to come to the United States to infiltrate the United States like moles in an espionage plot to prepare the way for the time when the Vatican would take over the United States. The Jews were coming because they'd been ordered to do that by an international cabal of Jewish financiers who were going to use them in a similar way to take over the economy of the United States. My sense is that many of these Klan members genuinely were afraid of these things, and that part of the reason they could accept these things is because of the sources. In other words, if you're told things like this by a source that you respect, they become accepted. In the Klan's case, one of the major sources were evangelical Protestant ministers. The Klan claimed to have 40,000 ministers. That was probably an exaggeration, but we know that there were thousands of evangelical ministers who were praising the Klan in their sermons and even urging people to join the Klan. And so you can understand why in a relationship, in a church, a sense of respect for that minister, why people are going to believe these things.
Do you have any sense in the course of your scholarship of this and research, do you have any sense of how genuine that fear was as expressed by those ministers? I mean, I know, was there an errant letter that said, hey, good news, the line about the Catholics and the Pope is we just, our receipts went up by 10%. I mean, I imagine people don't write things that explicitly, but I mean, do you have any sense of how genuine their belief was of this?
No, I don't, but I tend to think it was really genuine. I'm not sure how great the fear was, but it is also true, and this is what you were suggesting in the question you asked before this, that there were other motives for joining the Klan. In the first place, in many ways, the 1920s Klan was an evangelical revival. There were a lot of prayers, there were a lot of church services. The Klan liked to make donations to evangelical churches, in which they did this in a very dramatic way. They would, in their uniforms, they would march into the church and visibly, personally hand some cash to the minister. The other aspect of the Klan is that, and that was what you were raising before, is that at least at first it spread by a system of recruitment by commission. One of the things that the Klan did, and to the best of my knowledge, it may be the first ever social movement to do this, is that it hired a public relations firm to promote it. The Klan was a business. It was registered as a for-profit corporation. And the PR firm developed this network of recruiters, and anyone who brought in a member to the Klan and you had to pay a $10 initiation fee. And that, in the 20s, that was worth way over $100 today. This was not an organization of poor people. But the recruiters who got you to join could keep 40% of that. Then the person they had recruited could go out and try to recruit some other people and keep 40% of their initiation fee. And this went on and on until people find that they have sort of saturated the field and that there's nobody left to recruit. And in that sense, it's what we call a pyramid scheme, in which the early entrants gain from this and the later entrants don't. And I think that was part of the fact that the Klan declined after a while, is that opportunity to make profit in that way was coming to a close. But the other thing about the Klan, just to lay out one more of its attractions, is that it was in many, many locations, it was very prestigious to join the Klan. It was, in a way, functioned like something halfway between an old-fashioned fraternal organization and a new-fashioned Rotary Club, in which you could network with some other business people and make contacts that would be economically valuable to you. The vast majority of Klan members were actually what we would today call middle class. And furthermore, they weren't rural people. They, at the time, critics used to attack the Klan by saying, oh, they're just a bunch of rural hicks, uneducated, et cetera, et cetera. And that turns out to be absolutely false. The Klan had great strength in the cities. The educational level of people in the Klan was easily as high as the average in the United States. So we have to keep in mind that this was a not only a respectable, but in many ways people considered it a privilege to belong to the Klan.
A lot of small business owners and a decent amount of white collar workers, you write. And was there a relationship or any type of correlation between the you know, talk about Oregon and Chicago and, you know, northern cities, New Jersey. Was there a relationship between the number of immigrants in these areas and the membership of the Klan, or was it just sort of, was there a sweet spot in terms of proximity, right? Like, you know, if you're living amongst immigrants, maybe you're less inclined to join the Klan. But if you are living within 50 miles of an immigrant population, you're more inclined to join. Was there any type of, is there any type of breakdown like that?
Actually, I think the first part of what you said is true. If you're living with a lot of immigrants, like you might be in New York City, you are not that attracted to the Klan, in part because you may occasionally see these people as just ordinary people, and you know, they're not, don't seem to be terribly threatening. What is really extraordinary was the Klan's ability to rev up this kind of fear and hatred in situations where there weren't any of the hated, despised groups. I used Oregon for a couple of reasons, partly because it's my home state, but partly because it's such a perfect example of that. In Oregon in the 1920s, there were essentially no black people, way less than 1%. There were very, very, very few Jews. My guess is that the vast majority of Oregonians had never seen a black person or a Jew. And even Catholics were really a very small minority. And yet they were able to convince all these people that these Catholics and Jews were really threatening the overall welfare of the country and the state. I think that's a very important lesson there, that these fears are not actually based on any kind of experience.
That I think is fascinating. I mean, on one hand, I think it makes some sense, right? There's a lot of room there. There's no counterbalance to the stories that you're going to tell. And, you know, I imagine you can say the Jews have horns and there's no one around to check. You can't check you can't check and see if the horns are there.
That's true. But, you know, it's also true that there's something in the nature of a conspiracy theory that makes it very hard to disprove, because if you respond by saying, well, where is your evidence? There is no evidence of what you're saying. The response to that is, well, of course there's no evidence, because conspiracies are secret.
Right.
So you get a kind of a completely circular logic here that enables people to make claims that are completely impervious to disproof.
I wanted to ask this just before we go on. I have a bunch of other questions, but the baseball team that the Klan sponsored in 1927, they played the Hebrew All-Stars.
right.
Do we know the score?
I don't know the score of that game. I know they also played a Negro League, and in that game, set of games, they lost.
Well, I'm glad to hear
but
that.
But, I used the baseball team because I wanted people to understand how completely acceptable and public they were. You know, there's a photograph that shows the baseball team players on the bench with these uniforms that all read KKK on the back.
And you have of pictures in the book of fully robed KKK folks. I think it was going to a carnival in Colorado, just going on like a Ferris wheel.
The Klan liked to develop these huge outdoor pageants, and they, they were a super hyper patriotic organization, and used like to do this on July 4th, but they frequently did them in other places, and they were in many ways like county fairs, but county fairs multiplied by 100, because you get these newspaper reports that tell you that 20, 30,000 people were at these events, and they were exactly like these carnivals. They had rides, they had contests, they had the kind of games where you throw balls at things and can win prizes. They were kind of classic Americana, if you want to put it that way.
Let's talk about the role of women in the Klan. I found this fascinating. Tell us a little bit, maybe, you highlight, three women, Elizabeth Tyler, Daisy, Barr, I think it is, and, Alena White, who sort of, represent three different aspects of the Klan between the public relations, the sort of money, the profiteering, and the religious aspects. But broadly speaking, the role of women in the Klan.
Well, women clamored to join the Klan, and they developed an organization that came together eventually. It was called the WKKK, the Women's Ku Klux Klan. It was smaller, but it had about 1.5 million people. Furthermore,
and we should say at this time, that's close to almost 1.5% of what the American population was, roughly speaking, around that time.
Yeah. And also, I think we have to keep in mind that there's no evidence that they joined because their husbands joined or because their husbands wanted them to. And in fact, they actually became, not all of them, but some of their groups became very feisty in resisting the male domination of the Klan. For example, some of these groups began to refuse, when you had a little Klan chapter, a proportion of all the dues was also supposed to be sent up to the national headquarters. Some of these women's chapters just began refusing to do that. They wanted to control all their own money. But I think I think there were two things that led me to do that separate chapter. One is that I think it's really important not to imagine that women are necessarily a kinder, gentler group, that are less able to get involved in this kind of bigoted, racist stuff. But the other thing that surprised me was that in some cases, you actually had women in the Klan who were agitating for reforms that we really have to call feminist. This was particularly true in the writings of this one of the women you mentioned, called Alma White, who was a bishop in a small evangelical sect, and she was apparently a very charismatic speaker, and she published book after book after book of her sermons, and as well as her publishing a newspaper. And you see that the things that she's asking for are not so different from what suffragists had been asking for in the previous decade. She wanted women's property rights. She asked for greater prosecution of abusive men. She wanted women to have better access to higher education. You know, I've gotten quite a bit of pushback about that chapter because, again, I think there are people, including some friends of mine, who like to think that you should only use the label feminist for someone who is progressive on a whole range of issues, including being anti-racist. But I think we have to be honest about that and say that there are certain versions of feminism that are quite compatible with a bigoted movement like that of the Klan.
And the Klan itself was, in this era, was supportive of a woman's right to vote. A white woman's right to vote, right? Because the thinking was that the Klan was electing a lot of people, not secretly, right?
Right?
I mean, it was people were running not quite as the Klan's candidate, but sort of as the Klan's candidate. And winning.
Well, they were running as Klansmen, in which their identification was open. They were running in both the Democratic and the Republican parties, and they managed to elect 11 governors, something like 45 members of Congress, and thousands, or at least hundreds and hundreds, of local officials, state, county, municipal officials. They had a very sophisticated electoral strategy. You know, the only thing that I didn't put in the book in the form of an appendix, which you probably noticed, is at the very back, there is a chart that was created by the Klan that lists all the senators with, in this chart, the Klan's evaluation of how friendly that senator was to Klan ideas. And I wouldn't be surprised if they had the same kind of information that they put out about Congress people. They were masters at getting the vote out, and they were also masters at lobbying and at intimidating politicians by threatening that they would use all their votes against them if the politicians didn't go along with what they wanted.
We should say that this is a big part of both right and left politics, although the right has these, sort of weaponized the way that they score. You know, the Heritage Foundation will give you a score if you're a representative on based upon how you vote and taking those positions. I mean, did they pioneer that? Did the Klan pioneer that? Or was there a precursor to that?
To this working to get out the vote, you mean?
Not so much working to get out the vote, but this is a modern feature of politics where, you know, for Growth will score you. I mean, was the Klan the first outside group to do that?
I doubt it. I don't know that for sure, but I doubt it. You know, in political machines operated all over, and I'm sure that there were other organizations that tried to influence or more sharply to intimidate politicians. And of course, there were all sorts of ways in which people were literally buying votes in these days. So there was nothing new about that. I think what's new is that people don't usually associate that with a mass movement or with an organization like the Ku Klux Klan, because I think most people's images of the Klan have to do with violence. Now, this 1920s Klan was not 100% nonviolent. They were mostly nonviolent, but the fact is that I think they figured out that they could get further with an electoral strategy than they could by violence or by threatening violence. But there were exceptions. For example, in the West Coast, where you at that time didn't have very many African Americans, but you did have Mexican Americans, Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, Filipino Americans, the Klan was very, very flexible, kind of a an equal opportunity set of racism. So they would go after whoever were the sort of disadvantaged people in a particular area. They constantly attacked Mexican-Americans in California and Oregon and Washington, where there were many Japanese-American farmers. They even lynched some of them. So they did engage in some violence. And also they liked to have these raids against saloons. This is Prohibition, remember. And as evangelicals, they are officially supporters of Prohibition, although there were a lot of scandals because the Klan's people would get caught drinking. But the Klan's official propaganda was that it was only Catholics who drank and that it was only Jews who were the bootleggers. So they could racialize their attitudes about Prohibition. You also, the Klan violence has to do with something else that's an extremely important fact to understand this. And in this sense, it probably is similar to the first Klan. In the second Klan, the largest occupational category in per capita in relation to its size in the Klan were police officers or sheriffs or right. law and order officers. And the many, many local Klan chapters had very, very close relationships with local police forces. The police forces in several locations simply deputized large numbers of Klan's people. There are places where policemen were allowed to do their regular patrols in Klan uniforms. Even in a place like Madison, Wisconsin, which wow. people think of these days as a relatively liberal place, the police chief said that his police force was pretty thoroughly Klanified, as he put it.
And this is we should remind people, we're talking about the second wave, right? I mean, the...
Yes, the 1920s. In the 1920s, yes.
You know, the okay, I mean, that's stunning to me.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, there's one interesting anecdote about this vigilantism that I think many of your listeners may even have been familiar with because it is described in the autobiography of Malcolm X. It is about how some Klansmen on horseback really terrified and threatened his family and drove them out. And this happened literally when Malcolm X's mother was pregnant with him. Mm. And it was certainly must have been an absolutely terrifying experience.
All right. Lastly, I mean, as we sort of, you know, because there's sure. obviously some parallels to what's happening today. I mean, we have a right. resurgence. It's not necessarily branded as the Klan, but there's certainly similar sentiments. And, you know, Jeff Sessions it harkens back, you know, that whole notion of abstinence and the notion of you know, Jeff Sessions' work back in the probably the third wave of the Klan in Alabama. But one of the things that you write about is that there was no... The Klan did not commingle with sort of the more wealthy, mega-rich anti-Semites of the day, or it appears, right? I mean, because this is a time where, like, Ford was publishing Protocols of Zion, and there's not – they don't mix so much with the super rich. And one thing that occurs to me is that that money that exists – that money is available now – to these people who strike me would have been in the Klan in the 20s.
That's quite right. That's quite right. You know, there's a very interesting and complicated relationship between what you might call elite bigotry and mass bigotry, right? So in terms of the Klan's ideas, about, say, the inferiority of Catholics and Jews, their views did not differ from those of many very elite, even academic eugenists who had this notion of superior and inferior populations. This, for example, is the period in which most of the great universities had Jewish quotas to try to make sure that not too many Jews became students there. The Klan was a great supporter of eugenics. But on the other hand, you also have to remember that the vast majority of at least white Protestant Americans may have shared many of these beliefs, and that the difference had to do with the level of intensity, the level of anger that was revved up. But, you know, I do think, you know, several people have sometimes said to me, well, you know, the Klan had all these ideas, but there were probably many, many other Americans who were quietly mouthing the same ideas when they were talking to their friends. And I'm sure that that is true. But I think there is an important difference, because I think when people are whispering their bigoted views, the fact that they're whispering is a sign that they feel that there's something a little bit illegitimate or disreputable about it. It makes a big difference when people are shouting these views, and that is where I see very much connections with the present day, because I think we're living through a period in which there's been a re-legitimation of those views, in which you don't have to feel embarrassed to articulate that kind of foul stuff.
Yeah, and you know, I'm struck by, you had a particularly in the second wave of the Klan, a vast structure. I don't want to say corporate structure, but I mean close. And in some ways, there are major structures. I don't want to overstate this, but there are major structures that are out there on the right today. Whether they are through, you know, Koch-funded organizations, the American, you know, the AFP, the Freedom, there's a lot of these structures that exist out there that are at the very least funding a lot of where this comes from. I mean, frankly, I see it a lot. You know, a lot of this stuff lives online, and a lot of this stuff is funded, and it is funded in sort of concentric circles coming out of, you know, more diluted and less diluted versions of the anti-Islam, anti-immigrant, anti-black.
And also anti-Semitic.
Yes.
It's kind of ironic that we're seeing a rise both in anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic stuff.
Is there any clue as to what you could attribute this to from that era? I mean, because you're speaking about people who are not having direct experiences when we talk about the second wave, people who are not having direct experiences with that, with what they hate. They are not people who are suffering significant economic deprivation because they can afford to join this, and it's, you know, and maybe it's becomes more of a, I mean, are there other enticements that are present today that were like then, or what is it?
Well, you know, when you start to think about it that way, there are ways in which I think that this current situation may be a little bit more dangerous, and it has to do with what you were just talking about, which is that people we think of as elites, the richest people in the country, are funding this kind of loud, I hate the term populist, you know, even when people call it right-wing populist, but anyway, this kind of loud, bigoted thing, because they think that they can use it to make certain kinds of gains that are directly beneficial to them. You know, for example, the Klan did not have that kind of money coming in from what you might call the ruling levels of the top levels of the economy. And most of those guys, they probably didn't object to a lot of what the Klan was doing, but they weren't really a direct part of it. But today what you have is a situation is in which on the one hand you have the Trumpian revving up of this kind of anger, but you also have something else going on within the Trump administration, which is a continuation of policies that conservative Republicans have been after. Conservative and people we think of as respectable Republicans have been after for decades. The deregulation of everything, stop no regulations of the environment, no safety regulation, no regulation of Wall Street. You know, in other words, in many ways, there is a traditional Republican economic platform that is actually being aided by this kind of, you know, this kind of revving up of bigotry. And it's not surprising when you see that the word fascism is beginning to appear. So I do think that there is something a little bit unusual and a little bit different about our situation today.
The book is The Second Coming of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s in the American political tradition. Linda Gordon, thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that book on our site at majority.fm.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate your having me. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Happy Wednesday. Happy Wednesday. Fascinating. I really want to know how the Hebrew All-Stars did in that game. Someone's got to know.
I want a picture of those KKK cops.
Exactly. And, you know, this didn't come up. But apparently the KKK also in the 1920s sponsored a Miss 100% American pageant.
Wow.
100% American.
100% American.
Interesting how you'd begin to define that.
Right. Well, you know what I mean. Miss White, truly white American.
It's actually not that interesting. It's pretty straightforward.
When I said 100% American, what I meant was white American.
They told me I had to call it the Miss America pageant.
It's on this sheet, like MES America pageant.
The book is The Second Coming of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s and the American political tradition. Folks, you can support the free part of this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And we give you extra content every day, and you keep the show chugging along. In the meantime, today is Wednesday, which means that last night was Tuesday night, which means that the Michael Brooks Show was happening, Matt Taibbi.
Julia Salazar a little bit.
Julia Salazar.
Did the Grisham economic update. A lot of stuff happened. I will say in the post game, which is normally just for patrons, but is going to be for everybody as we launch the new YouTube channel, it was a little bit of wish fulfillment to be able to make fun of Sam Harris with Matt Taibbi.
Oh, I bet.
That was very fun. So
is he tuning into Sam Harris?
He had no idea who he was. So we played him two drops of him like whining about Neanderthal DNA. And Taibbi was like, yeah, I'd love to go on a road trip with this guy.
I was going to say, I would be surprised if he knew. He does not.
He was unaware of the IDW.
Yeah.
He does not.
He was aware. And it was so funny because
he
like,
focuses like a laser on what he's doing. He does not. Taken a lot of the garbage.
He's like, I don't know what those guys are, but I'm not young anymore. And I was like, dude, you're not that old, and this is definitely not a question of like youth. We're not like turning you on to something cool and trend setting.
Well, I mean, I think to a large
extent, the audience it is it is fair enough.
I think these guys speak to an audience.
Furious young masturbators in basements.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that is necessarily specifically the youth. But
are you thinking of a certain caller that we're probably going to get?
Listen. But the point being, though, I think largely speaking, folks like Jordan Peterson and Dave Rubin and Sam Harris and I lumped them all together.
As you should.
As I should.
As Barry Weiss did.
As Barry Weiss yes. did, and as they do in their stupid pictures. They're speaking to frustrated young men. I think that's true.
It's a multi-age coalition, yeah, I think.
He did know who
is multi-age.
He did know who Jordan Peterson was, vaguely, and we were able to play two really perfect drops for him.
I'm defenseless against that kind of female insanity.
I think that you will find in anything a breakdown of ages, but the fact is that you cannot be a YouTube phenomena and not have a preponderance of males from age 12 to 24. I mean, that's just even on our YouTube channel. Like our podcast has much different demographics. On YouTube, I think we probably have a lot more balance than a lot of. I mean, I've been told based upon, like for instance, TYT.
Internal documents, numbers, we have them.
We have a lot of different. In an impromptu conversation.
And it's more balanced.
Total impromptu
it's more balanced
conversation.
Than the other ones.
But ours is more balanced. But I think that also inhibits.
It inhibits some of our growth. But allow me just to say really quickly before we go on, patreon.com/TMBS, get the whole thing. Thank you.
And most of my friends have never heard of Jordan Peterson or any of these people, and I'm so jealous of them.
Yes. Believe me. I bring this up to people, and I'm like, I feel obligated that I really do. I mean, I've told the story plenty of times when old Matt used to say, like, hey, I want to look into this men's rights activist. Like, and I'm like, oh, dude, that's not politics.
He'd be like, God, you got to listen to this. There's someone on a thread on Reddit who's saying that women are making us lose our semen because of soy and food. And they're doing a big rally for men's rights and single fathers.
And
we'd be like, all right, man, whatever. I guess that's kind of funny. And then it's like, yeah.
I would literally say to him, like, dude, this is not politics. If you want to do it, that's fine, but it's not politics.
I do remember that.
And then 3 years later, these guys are like
running,
you know, third in line at the White House underneath the chief of state.
Shout out Binder, just got hired at Mashable.
Yeah. Congratulations, Matt Binder, new tech reporter at Mashable.
Nice.
And he's doing a good job at Doomed.
And speaking of podcast, Jamie, you guys recorded an Antifada episode the other night.
We did. We recorded the night before last. We're going to edit it tonight. Probably get it up tomorrow. We usually put them out on Wednesdays, but Thursday's not so bad. We talk about the Amazon strikes in Europe, and we talk about Elon Musk a little bit. We get into a little bit of his history, and people really seem to like it the last time I did my little socialist feminist Weird Al shtick, so I did that again.
All right. I'm not sure I totally understand, but the singing.
The songs are familiar, but the words are new.
There you go, folks.
Speaking
of words, gosh, tell us about a literary podcast, Matt.
Well, Literary Hangover, the first three episodes are already up on Saturday, coming out with Young Goodman Brown by Nathaniel Hawthorne. We take a deep dive. It's like sort of the first parable of the dark, satanic woods in America. And Nathaniel Hawthorne, we go into him as sort of like the height of sort of 19th century American bourgeois conservatism.
So, Nathaniel Hawthorne made some very big points.
All right, folks, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Also, betterhelp.com/majority. Check that out if you're looking for some access to therapists. All right, we got to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. We'll be right back.
We got a special song.
Oh.
I was going to say, can I tell you, this is by, are we playing that now?
I feel like we should have played this earlier. But
are we playing it now?
Yeah,
we'll play. William Lee is the composer. This was
an homage to the Zero Sum. And frankly, I mean, I didn't bring it up with the guest today, but I felt like a little bit of what she was talking about with social hierarchy.
I was actually quite impressed by you because I wanted you to be like, because I have a theory called the zero sum. Have you heard of this, professor? Do you see?
She actually.
And they joked to me about it, but it's real, God damn it.
She. You missed it when Ben Dixon came on and specifically wanted to talk about it because he totally agreed with me.
No, I didn't miss it because you literally told me that like probably 10 times in the show prep.
just the way you did on air.
What, today?
I missed it. No, when he was on. What are you talking about?
Oh, no,
I didn't
tell
you crazy?
I said we talked about that. These lines came from the Ben Dixon, when Ben Dixon wrote it. I didn't tell you that it was Ben Dixon's request.
No, I remember that. You think Ben Dixon wants to talk about Zero Sum today.
You weren't here.
No, I was here. I was definitely.
I think it might have been Jamie who wasn't here.
No, Jamie wasn't
what?
Here. I was here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
see,
no,
Jamie?
I remember you had this giant, you were like, oh my God, I thought something really amazing had happened. And I was like, Jesus, Sam, what's the news? Ben Dixon wants to talk about Zero Sum. I was like, oh my God, you're a lunatic.
I don't think I've gotten that excited about anything.
Well, that's why it was so disturbing.
All right, so, but nevertheless, that's where a lot of these clips come from, I think, that day. On the song.
Yeah, this is William. Again,
yeah, we'll
William
play
Lee.
It, and then we'll go, and then go into La Poupée. But I just want, you know, because people have turned off now the freebies.
It's very good.
It's a nice feeling. It's real. It's a nice feeling, sweetheart. Get me a beer. I totally get it. They are. You turn on the TV. Some iteration of me. Zero sum game. It's a nice feeling. Zero sum game. Zero sum game. It's a nice feeling. You're gonna lose your status. He is the king of his zero sum game. I totally get it. Zero sum game. They are. Zero sum game. Sweetheart, get me a beer. I go to La Poupée. I wish that was longer.
Follow up, please.